This week on Unboxed, I'm speaking with Nikki Lilly, who is a 19-year-old content creator who has lived, I think, 20 lives. She was diagnosed with AVM, which is a very rare condition, which creates a swelling on the side of her face, having been in and out of hospital since she was 6 years old.
I became very sick very quickly. Watching YouTube videos became my outlet when I was a sick kid stuck at home. There was a time in my life where this side of my face, my right side, looked like my left and vice versa. It's almost like you're mourning this person of like what your life could have been.
Finding content creation and building a business online as an area of escape and therapy for herself, she has been able to build this career that is truly astonishing. She's won a BAFTA, she's won an Emmy, and I wanted to speak to her today about how she's able to do everything she does to excel as a content creator, to build this amazing business online whilst going through daily suffering and trials with her condition, which causes physical pain that one can only imagine.
Make the best of the cards you've been dealt in life. If I can kind of begin to just like move the door a little bit for some people, even if it's just one more person, to feel like they can put themselves in these worlds they never otherwise thought they could be a part of, then that's like all I could ever hope for, to be honest.
Let's get into it with Nikki. Nikki, thank you so much for coming on Unboxed.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so I want to get into a lot of different things with you.
Sure.
You have been able to find success, and success at a real incredible level. You know, you've incredibly well known. You've done so much brilliant work in, for years now. How you managed to find that discipline, resolve, and commitment ultimately whilst going through so much physical pain every single day, because you're also very open about how you talk about you know what your experience is like on a daily basis, the routine you have to go through to manage your condition. I guess to start things off, for those who don't know you, who are you? Where did you come from? What is this? What's your origin story?
So I'm Nikki, but most people know me as Nikki Lilly online. I am 19 years old. I started...
Wait, you're 19 years old?
Yeah.
Sorry. Sorry, what?
Yeah.
You're 19?
Yeah, this time last... Well, actually, not this time last year, but...
I had no idea you're 19. No, you weren't doing your A-levels last year.
While doing, like, everything else.
My jaw's just literally...
Yeah, so...
What?
I know. I don't feel 90. I feel about 19.
You probably lived about 19
Honestly,
lives.
Honestly, I feel like it.
You're
19. I have...
So you were born in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
2004.
Uh-oh, make people, you feel old now.
How am I feeling? I was born in 1997. Normally people feel that...
Oh my God, they're like, you're so young.
Yeah, now I'm feeling... that's amazing. Wow.
Sorry, I'm the youngest in the room for once.
There we go. There we go.
So I've been doing social media, not like full time, but I posted my first video on YouTube when I was 8. And then I fully kind of started posting on YouTube when I was 10, more regularly. And I really just got into it as like a safe haven. I became very sick very quickly when I was 6 years old, and watching YouTube videos and kind of role play, pretending, you know, I was on TV and things like that became my like outlet when I was a sick kid stuck at home. And so YouTube is what I found to watch videos, but also to film videos, and my little channel became my corner of the internet to put my energy into and to escape. I started filming videos on there, did that for... I mean, have done it now for many, many years. And then since then...
So literally 11 years.
11 years, which is crazy because that's like when OG people were like finding their footing.
I just had Josh Peters. And
exactly.
From that
And Casper.
Casper's on last week.
Exactly. And that's like, I remember watching like Zoella and like the whole like Brit group. You know? So I was not like, you know, had no like social media presence then, but I remember like just being... absolutely obsessed with their videos, and like they were my source of happiness. So yeah, that's me. And then I kind of used YouTube to talk, I'm making videos to talk about everything that I loved, but also to cope with my condition and talk about the real sides of what it's like to have a chronic illness. And then from that I've done some TV bits and pieces, and then slowly kind of moved on to TikTok, started that whole thing.
Yeah, the point you said there, which I think was really interesting, is that you found YouTube as a safe haven for yourself when you were sick. So can you talk us through what happened at that time in your life when you said you got sick very quickly, and how did that impact your life, and then why was YouTube this safe haven? Why was it so needed for you at that point?
Yeah, so I was born with my condition. It's called AVM, or arteriovenous malformation, but shortening it is so much easier.
How many times have you said...
So many times, and I always trip over my words every time. It's just a tongue twister.
It is.
Say that five times. Oh my God.
Yeah.
So I was born with my AVM, but it was dormant till I was 6 years old. So I lived like as normal of a life as any child can up till that age.
And did your parents know that, so you say you were born with it, did you know that? No,
okay. No idea. So it's completely dormant. And because it's so rare, with AVMs, you can get it in any part of your body. It's basically a genetic fault when you're being like formed in, you know, the stomach. So yeah, it's a genetic fault, but it can become active at any age, really. So mine was triggered at 6, you know, it just started becoming active, and very quickly I had veins appearing on the right side of my face, swelling, pain, symptoms and things like that. And then within a few weeks I had lots of scans, lots of appointments, and it was a very long road, but because it's so rare, but we found out I had an AVM.
Oh, so you didn't actually know what it was?
No idea. So I just went to our GP because we thought, oh, maybe, you know, I've got some bruising or something or other. And my GP was really worried about it because he was like, I don't know what this
probably
is.
Probably never seen it before, right?
Never given seen it before. So rare. Yeah.
Do you know the numbers in terms of how rare it is?
So different types of AVMs affect different amounts of people. So a brain AVM, which is like the most common, can affect like 1 in 50,000. But mine, which is a facial and head AVM, affects 3 in 1,000,000.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's really
rare.
That's
right there, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So you can also get like limb AVMs, and they all come with their own difficulties. Yeah, they had no idea. They just were like, I need to refer you to another doctor as quick as possible. So then it was from a GP to like a more specialised doctor, and then that doctor referred me to a specialised children's hospital in London where I had lots of scans, and then they finally told myself and my parents that I had an AVM.
What year was, or how old were you at that point?
I was 6.
So they found out within that year. Okay.
It was really quite quick. It was about 2010, I think. It was all like a bit of a whirlwind. Mm. And to be honest, at that time, I think it was a blessing in disguise that I was so young, because I think I wasn't really aware of the magnitude of what I was being told or what exactly I was being told. You know, at 6, I think you're very unaware of what it's like to have an illness or what an illness is and how life-altering it can be. And I think the only illnesses you really know are like coughs, colds, you know. Mm. You'll be ill for a little bit, but then you spring
it's
back.
Always it's always temporary for
exactly,
the vast majority
temporary.
Of people. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think I thought it, if I had anything, it was that. Whereas my parents were dealing with the fact that, you know, their child was very sick, life was going to completely change as we knew it, and I was going to need operations, and yeah, life was really never going to be the same. Whereas for me, it's all quite a blur. Like, I can't go back to that time and relay anything because I was so young.
Was it almost like a whirlwind 100% of an experience to the point where, do you think in your mind it's kind of just merged into this blurry middle where it's, you know, you can kind of get from before that? Do you remember anything before that time?
Do you know what?
Right,
that's the thing. I feel like I definitely could, because by that time we're definitely forming memories, but I don't. And I don't know if that's because so much has happened that like my life before then, it's just like a distant memory. It's like it was never me.
Yeah.
The only time my memories may be triggered as if I watch like old family videos from when I was like 5 before.
What's it like watching those?
Difficult. I explain this a lot, and it's like something that I'm like working through at the moment, but it's almost like you're mourning this person. Mm. Of like what your life could have been, and who you could have been. Not necessarily that it would be a better person or, you know, my
just
life.
Different, yeah.
Yeah, just different. Mm. Like every single thing you go through, right, leads you to a different path. So it's just like, what would I have been doing? If not, where would I have gone? What would I be like as a person, traits wise, you know, mental maturity wise? So many different things that it's quite a difficult thing to work through, because it's also like, it's not like I was born with my face looking this way and no different. I don't really know any different now because I can't remember it.
Mm.
But there was a time in my life where this side of my face, my right side, looked like my left and vice versa. So I've kind of had to deal with my face changing before me, really, looking in the mirror every day and it looking different. So I think that's been the difficulty for me, is having complete loss of control over my appearance and there being nothing that I could do about it from a young age.
And I guess when you were, you know, 6, you're at a point, as you're saying, where 6-year-olds are relatively
kind
of getting on with life and living. And then you grow up and obviously you start to realize you're in more of a sort of social environment constantly, obviously mm-hmm. going through school, hard enough for anybody.
Yeah.
When you're in and out of hospital and you're dealing with, you know, a physical difference, as you said, that's even harder. So what was it like during that time, primary school, secondary school? What are your memories of that time? Good, bad, or indifferent?
Primary school was, and secondary school was a very difficult and tricky time for me because, you know, like you said, growing up is kind of all about like, it's supposed to be the best years of your life, right? In the sense that it's before you're an adult and before you have all of those, you know, rubbish things to worry about, supposedly. Yep. It should be the best years of your life, supposedly. Mm. And so I think for me, you know, up until that point, I was such an outgoing and chatty child up until the point of diagnosis. I was in like every club and extracurricular you could think of, Girl Scouts to dancing to like the boys' football team, I don't know. But I did it all. I had quite a good group of friends. But I think the thing that's good in primary school is that when you first begin school in general, your parents kind of like nudge you into like, they're like, go on, like, make friends. Like, they kind of help you with that, give you the push you need, and they're there normally, you know, to fall back on and support you. And you rely on them a lot more. I think the difficulty for me in primary school is that the people I'd met in primary school had seen me before my appearance started to change.
Yeah.
So they did know me before and what I looked like before. So then it was like,
because in year six, you're what, year one? No, year two probably.
Yeah. Yeah, so like
2 years at least.
Exactly. I don't know how much they remember like now looking back, but you know, then they did. And so I think it's like they could see my appearance changing before them. And again, because they're so young, they don't understand what's happening either.
And
they
three
just...
in a million.
Exactly.
It's not experience for any.
And it's not like you can easily explain that when you also
there's
don't...
no reference points. Like,
no, exactly. Yeah. It wasn't even in the NHS directory when I was diagnosed. Yeah,
is
I became.
It now? Better be.
I became the face of the pamphlet.
There we go.
Yeah. So even in at Great Ormond Street, if you walk through one of the hallways, you've got my like 8-year-old face there, like just like smiling. You know, like those presentations at school, like on the walls, like one of those. But my
What's that feel like for you? Interesting, like to be a landmark for like British medical history in this country in a way as well.
Oh,
right? There's
yeah.
something in that where it's actually for your story, your case, and as you say, all these doctors discovering what this condition.
Yeah.
I mean, there's what's that like to be the face of?
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, you know, AVMs have been around for years and years and years before even I was diagnosed, but it wasn't really known about by many people aside from the people that had the AVMs and the doctors that were trying to manage the symptoms of them. So I think the difficulty with me has been, you know, I'll never take the credit for like being the first person to have an AVM because I wasn't.
Course,
There's so many people before me, but I guess I was one of the first people to put it out there and to share what it's like to live with one on social media. And I think the difficulty with it is that every single person's AVM is different. Like any single person's, you know, struggles with any illness is different. It's relative to them. And there are some people that have an AVM on their arms. There's some people that have an AVM in their brains. And we can only relate to each other so much. So I guess the difficulty for me is I never want to seem like the mouthpiece of all people with AVMs or all people with visible differences, because there's so many different visible differences too. With me starting videos, it was also to try and cope with and navigate the trials and tribulations and the ups and downs, the high, the low of having a chronic illness and dealing with an AVM myself, that it was like, well, why don't I share this? You know, I'm navigating this myself. And
it becomes a form of therapy in a way, right?
Completely.
You're getting it out there. You're able to, and I think you built an incredible, it seems like you built an incredibly supportive community as well, where people are really, as you document your journey and share that so openly, people want to support you in that too. For those who don't know, and I guess it sort of leads into then, you know, how you've been able to have that resolve and that mindset. But what is it like dealing and managing and, you know, supporting yourself with a chronic illness?
It's very difficult because with a chronic illness, it doesn't stop. You never get any rest from it. It's a 24/7 thing you deal with. And with AVMs, they are life-limiting, life-threatening. Some are. Mine can be because it's one of the biggest and life-affecting symptoms is bleeding. So I can get like life-threatening nosebleeds where I can lose so much blood very quickly. So all over your body you have arteries, capillaries and veins, and your capillaries are supposed to be between your arteries and veins. But for anyone that has an AVM, so for me in the right side of my face and head and behind my eye, I don't have the capillaries where they should be in between my arteries and veins. So it means that my arteries and veins collide directly into each other rather than the capillaries being in the middle of them to kind of almost balance them out a bit. And because one's high flow and one's low flow, that direct collision causes a build up of pressure, an abnormal tangle of blood vessels. It kind of looks like a tangle of like white cables, kind of. When it shouldn't. It should just be branches. And yeah, that causes a build up of pressure, which leads to bleeding, leads to swelling, leads to all of the other stuff that comes with it. So with the bleeding, it's basically like a pressure cooker that's kind of like a build up of pressure, and then it will just go.
Okay. So that's where if you bleed, so your nosebleeds can be, like, as you say, life threatening because it has you don't have the wiring per se
exactly.
It should be to manage those.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, wow. Yeah.
Okay. So then in terms of daily dealing with this, and something you talk about a lot on your vlogs and videos, like, what is that reality like for you?
Yeah, so I've been taking tablets 3 times a day to help my blood clot for 13 years. That's one thing. I have chronic pain as well. So that's another side effect of having an AVM. So I'm my eye is constantly in pain, or I get headaches, which can be part of pressure buildup. So I've had a lot of, you know, heavy duty painkillers to just keep it manageable and keep me able to somewhat keep ticking along with my day. I have had obviously so many operations over the years and so many different treatments, which are just things I've gone through since I was 6. So today I've had about 96 operations,
yeah,
give or take, yeah,
in 15 years,
yeah,
right?
So yeah,
13 years,
yeah.
Not, wow.
Yeah, if I wasn't at home, I was in hospital, and if it wasn't at hospital, I was at home. We called it my second home when I was younger.
What were they like there?
They were amazing. Everyone from all over the world goes to Great Ormond Street.
Yeah.
So it was the best place I could possibly be. And the doctors and nurses were so supportive. And essentially, because I spent so much time in hospital, they became my friends almost.
Yeah.
Especially the nurses, you know, who would spend all day caring for me and things like that. Mm. Which I think is also part of why I've matured so quickly, is because when I was diagnosed and I did become very sick and symptomatic so quickly... I was constantly surrounded by either my parents or the doctors and nurses at hospital. So, like, they became my friends. They became the people that I spoke to and connected with, and, like, who I was around. Mm. So not only did I mentally mature so quickly because I went through a completely, like, life flipped upside down, life-altering thing, but also because they were adults that I was around day in, day out. So those are just some of the things I go through. I mean, you know, with my nosebleeds, I never know when they're coming. So I've constantly got packet tissues in my pocket. I'm constantly just, I call it like being in fight or flight mode all the time, because
you're kind of on edge, just waiting for
completely
something,
just like hypervigilant, because there's no like, oh, I've got a headache, in about half an hour I could have there's no warning, which I think is one of the worst parts about it, because you're never really in, I kind of call it being like physically present but not mentally. So I'm not really ever like in my body, because I'm just so like aware of my surroundings. If I have a nosebleed, okay, where's my nearest exit? Where's my nearest, like, you're thinking of a plan B, plan C, game plan, exit plan of anything happening before it's even happened. And you know, there's a lot of places that I will avoid going to because they feel more scary, they're more you know, they're more difficult to get out of. So like,
if they don't have that plan B, C, like,
exactly,
you don't want to ever feel trapped, because
exactly,
you know, you want to, as you say, physically you want to enjoy your life and do all the things that you would do anyway, but mentally you always have to be prepared, and therefore in certain situations it's not even worth going to. Have there been times where you've, you know, you've like taken yourself out of things, or you missed out on things that you
100%.
Would love to do because of that?
Yeah, 100%. There's been so many things. You know, I'm very grateful that I sometimes will be invited to like trips away with brands. And the only way that I'll be able to go on those is like depending on where it is, and if it's somewhere that's like got kind of decent hospitals and things around, and if a guardian can come with me, because I need that support system, because they get it.
Yeah, you need to understand.
My mum
you know,
or dad have been with me since I was 6, going through this
They've been on this journey too.
Exactly.
What's it been like for them the whole way?
I'll never 100% know what it's like, because I think being a child and being the person going through it is so different to being the parent and watching your child suffering, basically. You know, their lives completely flipped upside down, just as mine did on that same day I was diagnosed. My mum had to give up her job soon after I got diagnosed and become my carer.
Well, I mean,
essentially.
96 operations. Yeah. And, I mean, that's the operations. How
exactly,
much time
just
were you
the
probably,
operations.
How many, if you were to count up the days or maybe even years you probably spent.
Honestly, yeah, so many. There was, when I first started going in and out of hospital, I don't know why I did this, but I would keep my, you know, like hospital bracelets.
Bands.
And
then like I was festival like, bands. But
yeah, honestly, I was like, the only festival I'm going to.
01, 2,
forget Glastonbury.
Yeah, come on, it's a real party right here.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I'd like keep them and I was like counting them and I was like, there's just too many to even keep anymore.
You know, people have
drawers. Like, I had like a shoebox I kept of them, like mementos. And I was like, actually, also, this is a bit sad. But, you know, my mum had to give up her job and my dad was going to work and then at the end of the day coming to visit me in hospital or like, you know, being called at work from my mum saying, oh, she's had a nosebleed. Or my mum also had to give up working because she was getting calls like on at work when I was at school, which was very rarely or after I got diagnosed. Like my attendance was like 18% in the final year of primary school. She'd have to leave and, you know, have to be available at the drop of the hat to pick me up from school if I'd had a nosebleed or was in a lot of pain or
etc. So you very quickly went from, you know, being a child going through the experiences that most children go through to then basically needing full-time care.
Exactly.
And then how do your family, you know, both your parents working, how do you, they then have to flip your whole life again, their whole life.
And I have a brother and sister.
Your brother and sister,
so that's also very difficult. They're both, they don't have any kind of like physical health chronic illnesses, but when I was about 8 years old, my mum and dad and myself started going to America every 6 to 8 weeks for me to get medical treatment because I'd had 9 operations here, and at the time there was just not enough research and there was not enough into it for treatment options. And unfortunately, because AVMs are so rare, there's not enough funding into finding definitive treatments or a cure for them.
And how many specialists
exactly
you probably met
exactly. So really the only treatments you can have are to try and keep symptoms like bleeding, like pain, swelling at bay. The doctors in the UK basically, from getting a lot of different opinions, said, I'm so sorry, but we can't do anything else for you. And I was still having symptoms and I was still having a lot of bleeds and was very unwell. So we started going to America. We were going to Colorado. And in those times, you know, my parents were having to leave my brother and sister at home, you know, with family and going with me to America. And the first time I was in America, I had to stay for about 8 weeks because I was so unwell, I couldn't fly back.
Right.
So that's also like my brother being like 13, just starting secondary school. My sister, it's such a blur.
Yeah. But in,
like, you
in
know,
times where they're going through their own lives, and obviously everyone in your family has had to navigate.
They've
this
all
and
gone
support
through.
You. It's all been one big journey together. Really,
our lives will never be the same. Like with everything we've been through as a family, you know, I'm very lucky that my family unit's very strong, and I think this has probably made us even closer together. We've kind of been forced to, but you know, I've always had a very strong and supportive family unit, and not that they ever would, but my brother and sister have never made me feel. You know, because obviously, you know, even from a young age, I was very aware that I was pulling my mum and dad away from my brother and sister. And they very much lacked, like, the support physically and mentally that they could have done with because they, my mum and dad weren't physically present sometimes in their lives. And so I was very aware of that. But my brother and sister, who are older than me, never made me feel guilty of that, you know.
So you're the youngest?
Yeah, I'm the youngest. I'm the baby. So my sisters...
They had to look after you, come on.
I know.
They
had
no choice.
Yeah, I remember I did like a medical story video when I was about 10. I actually filmed it in Denver in like my hotel room. And that was one of my first videos to ever do really well. And it's when I first did like a dedicated video to my AVM. Because I'd never done one like dedicated to talking about.
Yeah,
like,
you mentioned in reference.
Exactly.
But not, like, here's
Okay. And I remember in it, like at 10 years old, I was like, I feel really bad. Like I'm taking my mum and dad away from my brother and sister. Like, so I was very aware of it. And so I think for me, like they never made me feel like that. But we've all gone through our own hardships in different ways as a result of my condition and how much it's altered our lives.
And this is the bit that I want to get into, is how that's made you so much stronger and how that's given you so much in terms of mindset and ability. Even at 8, I could imagine you're, again, you've lived 10 lives.
Honestly,
years, right?
Feel about 100.
Yeah, you start making YouTube videos and YouTube becomes this safe haven. So when did that really start to kick on for you?
I can tell you it didn't kick off from like day one. But I was okay with that because for me, YouTube was my outlet. I honestly, because I was so young, I didn't even realise you could turn it into a job or you could get followers on it. I had no idea. For me, it really was, I need something to have some escapism from, to find some positivity and have an outlet in. And that's what making videos became. And I remember I used to, you know, watch like Zoella and things like that. And it was everything to me. You know, I could watch those videos on my iPad in hospital. And that was like half an hour of escapism from the reality of my life. And I almost felt like, you know, I'd watch their vlogs and I felt like their friend, almost like a fly on the wall, which I think was the beauty of YouTube back then, especially.
It's changing is a bit now, isn't it?
A lot, yeah. It's all very like kind of clean cut, whereas then it really was like, you know, Zoella was like girl next door, like anyone felt like they could be her friend, which was I think the appeal of her. I kind of one day got my iPad out and just thought, you know, I do these little videos all the time, let me do another one. And then I filmed this like really rubbish tutorial, didn't know anything about makeup. But I remember asking my mum and dad, would I be able to like create a channel to just put this video on? It's just like a little like video bank for myself, project for myself. Yeah. I've got nothing else to look to or find enjoyment in. So this is, you know, something for me. And I think initially my parents were quite nervous about it, especially my mum. She was a bit like, oh, I don't know, because by this point my appearance had changed drastically, and you know, the outside world isn't kind sometimes. As a child, you're not really aware of that because you're kind of in a bubble.
And they want to protect you and look after you and not make your life harder through a decision
Like that, right? So I obviously wasn't aware of that. I was very kind of like unknowing to it. It became my way to just find some enjoyment in life. I think when I was diagnosed, I really lost my sense of self again. I went from being such an extroverted, outgoing child to just very lost, very introverted, a recluse. I didn't leave my house because I was so underconfident in the way that I looked. If I did leave my house, I'd often be stared at because of my appearance. So if I wasn't in hospital, I was at home anyways, regardless of whether I was well or not, because and had a good day and could have left the house, because it was like my shelter, it was my safe place where I wasn't going to be stared at. Even now, if I leave my house, I'm still very kind of like, the world doesn't feel safe anymore because I'm not in my room, I'm not in my house, I'm not in my safe space where I know I won't get stared at or made to feel like ostracized or like an outsider. I think when I was younger it was much worse, because I also think the beauty of filming videos is that if people stare at me now, it may be like 60% it's because they recognize me because of my videos,
true.
And 40% because I look different to what's deemed as normal or average. Whereas back then it was like, if they looked at me, it was 100% because of my appearance. So I feel like that's been one nice thing, is that I've kind of...
And you must have people coming up to you in the
street.
Yeah,
I do. Yeah. I've kind of redefined why people look at me or why people know who I am. It's now, you know, they notice my condition and they're like, oh, it's Nikki. Whereas, you know, back then they noticed my condition, just my condition. And I think navigating it was really difficult, because I don't think I realised that people could be so unkind. And it made me feel so uncomfortable and kind of like a fish in a fishbowl that everyone was kind of staring at, basically. And even at school, you know, I'd get so many questions like, oh, like, what's happened to your parents? Or like, oh, why do you look
and
like
kids,
that?
Kids are very direct. I've got two, right?
A lot of it's out of curiosity, but there's no like sugarcoating anything.
And you found as you've gotten older, that's gotten easier. Getting out of your bedroom, not being, you know, in that kind of YouTube bubble, so to speak.
It's definitely gotten easier. I think that with time, I've learned to take things less like personally, because with kids, like, I've always believed that like parents should do their utmost to educate their children about different types of people, appearance wise, you know, background wise, culture wise, everything. And that's part of like why someone will or will not stare at you or like have loads of questions. I was in the lift, and I just got in the lift with my mum and this other mother and her son, not that much younger than me, had come into the lift and was just staring at me, and I felt so uncomfortable. And I was like, oh my God, get me out this lift. And I could just hear him, not even trying to whisper, go, Mum, why does she look like that? Like, I'm scared. She looks like a monster. And instead of the mum being like, that is not okay, that's not how we are, and not using that as a point to educate their child, they said, it's okay, honey, we'll be out of the lift soon.
When you said that on the Labo video, I was literally...
Yeah, it is. Jaw-dropping.
Really? Like, if my kid said anything like that, you don't want to know.
Yeah, it's like
that's the disgusting thing to say. And also, again, children need correcting, and you need to
totally. You have to learn
to almost validate
sometimes.
That, and act like that's okay. Is shocking.
Yeah, that's shocking. It. Like, if my child did that, like, I don't know what I'd do. Like, if they did, I'd use it as a point to be like, well, there's different types of people in 100%. The world. And, you know, she has a medical condition, but that doesn't make her any different. Like, my bio literally says, I look different, but I'm the same as you, which is a fact of the matter. Mm. But the fact that she basically condoned her child's behaviour and made me appear more like a monster by, like, consoling them, like, it's okay, honey.
Yeah.
We'll be out of the lift
soon.
You're justified
in what you're saying.
What's scary here? Like, I'm a child. Like,
But that's also why I think what you do is so brilliant, because you're able to demystify what is an incredibly rare condition that most people will have never experienced or seen before. You're able to bring all of that to the table and show exactly who you are and how brilliant you are so consistently and so often. And again, and this is the big thing, that you're 19 years old. I just can't believe, again, I'm not that much, I'm 26, right? But like, you're 19. I cannot believe just how mature, how wise, how brilliant, and how much you've done in such a young age.
Thank
and how
you.
Well you're able to advocate for inclusivity and for as you say, other people who have physical differences as well, because I think that's a big part of what you do. It's not just around, as you say, you being
not
the only person with this. It's actually saying, look, I'm putting myself out there, and I'm brave enough to be vulnerable, be honest, be real, and to bring everyone on this journey.
Totally.
And I want to do that so that other people don't feel scared to.
Totally. Thank you. Yeah, that's it. Like, I never want to seem like I'm like the only woman and I'm like the poster child or anything like that. And I never set out, you know, to be that. It just kind of happened, and it was a space where there was very much, especially back then when I started making videos, lack thereof people with disabilities, physical visible differences and things like that. So I kind of naturally became one of those people at the front line, I guess. But I think for me, it's just ultimately the disability and visible difference space, it will always be harder to kick down the doors into getting opportunities. You know, it's like that with different races, different sexualities. It's like that with so many things where you're different to what normal is supposed to be in different ways. And with disability and visible differences, it's been very, very, very difficult. But if I can kind of begin to just like move the door a little bit for, you know, some people, even if it's just one more person, to feel like they can put themselves in these worlds they never otherwise thought they could be a part of, then that's like all I could ever hope for, to be honest. And if I can be part of being a mouthpiece to getting people's voices heard and concerns out there, or grievances answered or heard, then that's like all I could hope I could do, really. So it's not just kind of me doing this for like myself, which is how it began, because it was a coping mechanism for me, but it's also, you know, turned into me hopefully just being part of being the change for other people.
100%. And then obviously fast forward from the 8-year-old who puts on the camera and starts YouTube to now, and you've got an incredible career in this space. I mean, can you tell us quickly about some of the things that you're doing and that you've done, some of the crazy experiences that have come off the back of you becoming a very successful creator?
From my YouTube channel, I was found by BBC, and I've done quite a few things with them now. So at the time, CBBC, the children's BBC, had a series called My Life, and each episode was about a different child and their lives, you know, some disabilities, just different things. And they wanted to do one about my life, a documentary about me, and it was called Born to Vlog, and it was about basically my journey with vlogging and things like that. This was back in 2016, so still a few years on from YouTube. I was just plodding along with my YouTube, happy, you know, happy as Larry, doing what I was doing, posting. And they wanted to basically do something about my story, and that wound up winning an Emmy. Which was
just an Emmy. I mean,
casual Emmy. But it's just crazy. Like, I couldn't actually wrap my head around it, so I don't think I understood the significance of it. Because I was like, I don't get it. It's just my life, though. Like,
do you have an Emmy at your house?
Yeah,
that's pretty. That's
it's very
something.
Heavy as well. When they gave it to me,
you'd
I was
hope
like,
so. It's an Emmy.
I know, but I didn't. My little
thing.
Arms. I was like, literally, I let out like a. Like, you lift up a weight. So that ended up winning an Emmy a couple years later, and it was about basically following the highs and lows of my life for about a year. And it followed me to you know, treatments in the UK at the time, America, so many different things. Actually, at the same time, I was also filming Junior Bake Off, which is the children's bake off, and I wound
up baking.
I don't bake as much now, but I am good at it because I wound up winning it. So I have the like little cake stand that says Junior Bake Off.
What are you more proud of, the Emmy or Junior Bake Off trophy?
Do you know what? Oh, do you know why it's hard? Because with Junior Bake Off, it seems like obviously the Emmy, but with Junior Bake Off, because like every child on it was on like a level playing field, and it was like I was on it in spite of my condition.
You won,
And I won in spite of my condition when all the other children didn't really have conditions. Like had slightly less kind of hardships they had had to overcome to get to that point. I always loved baking. That alongside YouTube was my outlet. Baking it was like therapy to me, and I when I was diagnosed never ever thought in my wildest dreams I'd actually be able to be on the show because of everything I'd gone through. I was like, okay, that's a write-off, you know, it was a nice dream but it's never gonna happen. And I just applied on a whim, and so the fact that like I overcame everything and like not just got on the show but like won it, that was like insane to me. But with the Emmy, obviously it's incredible because it's like people were impacted enough by my story to think it was like worth an Emmy. I wound up having an interview series with CBBC as well called Nikki Lilly Meets, and I did 40 episodes of that, three series, which was actually an incredible experience.
Isn't, you must have, what, 16?
I started it in 2017, I was like 13. Yeah, so at 13, I interviewed Theresa May.
13, you interviewed the Prime Minister, won an Emmy, won Junior Bake Off, and had your own show on CBBC at 13 years old.
Yeah, exactly. So it was mental. I don't think I realised back then how crazy and abnormal that was at the time. As in, like, I don't think I fully processed it, how, like, unusual that is to ever happen. But yeah, I had the interview series and it gave me the opportunity to speak to so many people I never in my wildest dreams would have otherwise. And quite a lot of them I've become friends with, like, you know, Toph and like, I mean, I'm not friends with Theresa May, but like, you know, when she was Prime Minister, she'd send me the old Christmas card and things like that. And like I did Jamie Oliver and Nicole Scherzinger, like such a wide, you know, range of people. And I'd speak to them about what they were like when they were my age and what it was, what they were like before they became who they are to give, you know, kids and everyone watching the to know, like, you know, you can do whatever you put your mind to, really. So I did that, and yeah, did 40 episodes, which is crazy.
A lot.
And then I was I received a BAFTA special award. So it's like a BAFTA that's like chosen for you to receive by BAFTA. You don't win it. So
For the show.
Not for the show, just in general for my work. But normally people get it at the end of their careers.
It's like a special recognition.
That's a special recognition award.
Like Lenny Henry gets a special recognition at
that's
BAFTA
it. So the people like then that had got it were like Jacqueline Wilson and like David Tennant and like loads of different types of people. It was like no one ever got it that young. So I actually have I was in the Guinness Book of World Records for the youngest ever person to receive a BAFTA special award.
You're just racking it up right now.
Light work.
You're just
I'm
showing
joking.
Off, mate. You're just showing off. That's amazing.
But yeah, so I received that, and also my I then did a second My Life a couple years later, but it was called I Will Survive because I'd been through a lot health-wise in those couple of years since the last one, and that also was nominated for a BAFTA. So it was just
whirlwind. And you work with amazing brands.
You've had
tons of experiences too, and it's you've been incredibly successful as an entrepreneur, as a business owner now, right? I mean, how have you found that kind of growing up now, getting into, you know, obviously you're 19, a year into adulthood, but anyway, and you've got your own business and you've been building an incredible business and content platform for a long time now. What's it like on the business side of things? How do you find all of that to kind of navigate?
It was definitely like a whole new world, you know, turning something that I think anything you turn from a passion into a business, it's always a bit like this feels a bit strange because I think you see it in a slightly different light. You know, they always say when you turn something you love into a business, it's like you enjoy it less, you have less
you're
less burden to do it. But for me, I think it was also an amazing thing that I was like, wow, something I love doing I can also have a career out of. That was so like crazy to me, and I was very grateful that that was a possibility. I think something that became quite difficult for me was that something that I did love and that was like my hobby turned into my job. It was kind of a natural progression. But at the same time, it made things a lot more difficult because the lines were blurred a little bit. It was like, you know, I'm doing this ad and I'm very grateful. But at the same time, it was like, if you're not feeling it, you have to still film it, you know?
And for most people, them not feeling it, you might be, you know, they're a little bit tired. For you, it's Operation 96. And it's dealing with your daily pills and
that's
treatments and side effects. It's like being up for it. This is the big thing for me that I'm just in awe about you with, one of the many things, but it's how you have a career which in itself is difficult and hard enough, and you know, you've sustained that, not only sustained it, you've built it, you've done all these incredible things, but again, you've done it all whilst having to deal with
serious
physical challenges which most people on their own couldn't necessarily deal with, let alone have a career as well. I mean, how do you find that? Like, what are your strategies for navigating those two worlds? Or is it that physical, mental separation that you sort of found yourself in? What is it?
It's definitely difficult, and I think it's a bit of kind of like a work in progress. I don't think I've still got the balance, like, oh, I know, you know, I've got, you know, the weights the way that they're supposed to be. I think that I've realised that it's a bit of a toss-up. I've learned to prioritize certain things. Even like, you know, when I first started being invited to events, I was like, I need to go to every single one. I need to say yes to everything because I was so grateful. And I didn't want to like miss anything because you feel like then you're missing an opportunity.
Well, when's this going to end?
Exactly. But then at the same time, you're getting burnt out so quickly. And then not only are you getting burnt out, I've got all the other things that I'm dealing with my chronic illness of, if I'm having a bad day with pain or if I've had a nosebleed, you know. So I think for me, it's always been, and what my manager's really great with now is he's always like, you know, the other day I had a nosebleed and I was about to get ready for an event. And it's annoying, but especially when you do look forward to some, but he's always like, health comes first, you know, and always, that's the fact of the matter is health comes first. And I've just learned to prioritize the things that ultimately are the most important, which is like anything to do with health, anything to do with like family and friends, like those are the things that will always be utmost for me. And also I think for me, I'm quite like, I get very drained very easily from just like social interaction, because I think when you're going to events, you feel like you're kind of having to present your best self as well. Yeah. And although it's not like people force you to feel that way, it's just like how you feel. Yeah even when you make videos, you're like, you're more upbeat self. Yeah. You know, you're presenting yourself
again,
in a certain
way. To do that whilst also potentially having headaches the whole time. Or having swelling in your eye, like that is an added pressure. It's hard.
Exactly. So I think for me, I've been in this industry enough as well that like, let's say I've got like an ad due. A brand knows that I have a chronic illness, so if you looked at my socials, then you should know that it's like, I have a chronic illness that I don't have control over, you know?
Yeah. Things happen.
Exactly,
may come up, will come up, but that's fine, be flexible.
Exactly, so they kind of have to be lenient as well, like, you're not a very nice person if you're not lenient with that.
I was going to say, I mean, if you said anything other than yes,
oh my God, exactly.
Yeah.
Last year, I had a huge, huge operation. And I was out of the count of filming for a lot longer than I thought I'd be. It was like, what I thought would be 2 months was 4.5. So that's like, you know, out of working for a long time. So the amount of content that I had ready to film was like expended very quickly.
I've got a game for you.
Oh my God, I love a game. Oh no, what kind of game?
It's a nice game. Okay, so I have a box. And inside this box are a few cards.
Okay.
Pick a card at random.
Okay.
And then tell me what you think when you see the card. Read it out and then...
Oh, are they all me?
They're all you.
Oh my God. It's me in hospital. It says Operation 2, wish me luck.
Yeah.
On Instagram.
What was the story behind that? Was that the one 2 years ago you were just referencing?
Well, no, the one that was last year in September. So it was really recent, that one. 13-hour operation.
13
that was
hours.
Crazy.
What was the reaction like from your community? Because again, sharing this stuff is so powerful, right? But I think, what was the reaction like from people who...
That one was, I think they knew that it was a really long time coming. So with that operation, my doctors had taken about a year to come up with a game plan for what they were actually going to do in the operation.
A year to
put
the strategy for it.
Yeah. I mean, they could have been a bit quicker, to be honest. Yeah. Maybe shorten that to 6 months.
Yeah.
Took the time, but... Yeah. Yeah, it was one that like was always kind of shadowing over me. Like I knew it was like impending, but you know, when it finally happened, it was like, my God, the penultimate operation is happening. So they supported me through it, but they knew it was like this looming thing for me that was giving me a lot of anxiety. And it was also going to have me, it was probably the longest I'd ever been out of working and things like that because of my health in a long time. And so I guess the difficulty with my operations is that so many people, like I remember my operation last year and when also I had this operation, which was about, I think, a couple of years ago, I'll say like, oh, you know, because I share the good and the bad of life and the ups and the downs like anyone should, especially in terms of my health journey. And I put on my story like, today's the day of my operation. And they obviously knew what it what it meant. And so you get lots of like good lucks and things like that, and lots of people saying like, how did it go and things. And in those times, I actually find it easier to just not even look at my phone, because I can find it all a little bit overwhelming. Yeah. And I think in those times, it's like, wow, life is feeling really real right now. It's just, it never gets easier. Having these operations never gets easier. You know, often like people on the outside, sometimes we all do this as humans. I think it's just trying to put a positive spin on things, but they'll be like, well, you've done it once, like however many times you've done it, you can do it again. It doesn't make it easier.
And no one will know what it's like to be 6 years old, have your life upended, to go through 96 operations, to also have the career that you've had. No one will know what that cocktail is.
No, exactly. Right? And just because I've done it however many 96 times doesn't mean it gets easier. You don't bounce back quicker. Mm. If anything, you bounce back slower, because each time with any hardship, the more you hit down, the harder it is to get back up again and spring back. You know, yeah. When I was younger, like in this picture from like my operation 2 years ago, I probably sprung back so much quicker than I did from operations I've had since then, because it's just with each one you have more mental, there's more mental turmoil, more physical turmoil to spring back from. But at the same time, when I do then open my phone and do then finally look at the messages, it's overwhelming, but in like a beautifully positive way of people just wanting to check in and see how I am. It's like, you know, my social media has become like a true, like extended family for me. And that's the beauty of it. So like when I meet people on in person, it's like, well, you're one of those people family.
Yeah. So it's amazing.
Yeah, it's very bittersweet. Ah, my 1 million. Oh my gosh, this is crazy.
What was that like to hit a mil?
Insane. When I hit a mil, this was, I remember I hit a million on YouTube and TikTok on the same day.
That doesn't happen to most people.
No. Yeah, it was crazy. Amazing, I mean, on YouTube, it was so much more crazy because I'd been doing YouTube for so long. It was the long game, and it would never felt like a foreseeable thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was all about, like, the golden play button and, like, everything that
Did
came
you get yours?
It. Yeah, I got mine. Good. But it was, like, the new play button, you know, not the old one.
The
my silver one's,
on.
Like, in the glass, like, frame. Yeah,
they
that's
have
the best one.
The
yeah. But I think it was just, like, I was proud of myself because ultimately it's never what I worked. It was not my, like, yeah, every day, this is why I do it, because I want to get to 1 million.
But nice validation for
yeah,
all
exactly.
that time.
Yeah, exactly. It was the validation and that, like, a million people had tuned into what I was doing and cared enough about my story to, you know, listen to it
and
take time out of their day.
Not just watch
and
it, subscribe.
Yeah,
be
that's
on that journey. Yeah.
Why I almost find, like, 1 million on YouTube is so much bigger, I think, than 1 million on TikTok, because it's so easy to just follow someone on TikTok, and so many people do it just kind of
YouTube's
like
more in, that's an investment.
It is. It's an investment to even sit there for 10 minutes and watch a 10-minute video. You're investing 10 minutes of your day rather than like 15 seconds.
Yeah.
Also, because I lost so much self-confidence, you know, when I was diagnosed with my condition, it was like, Nikki, enough people want to hear about your journey and like care about you and care about what you're doing.
Yeah.
And so I think there was a lot of beauty in that I'd built this community of like 1 million people, and it's just a lot of people. Like, it's actually crazy.
If you
like
really think about it.
I know. I went to Wembley Stadium this year, and I'm like, that's 50,000-ish people. Like, that's that times so how like so many. Like, that's crazy. So
we'll
I think
leave that
for
to
me,
the maths people in the
I know. I know.
Way.
I'm like, however many. However many, I'm not gonna try right now. No. So I think for me, it was just like being proud of myself that, like, in spite of everything, once again, I'd managed to...
Hard enough for anyone
somehow,
to get to a
million somehow,
subs,
yeah.
But you did it as well as going through serious chronic illness.
Yeah.
Constantly. It's tremendous.
It's a damn lot of people. That's a good one too. BAFTA.
That's the BAFTA
pick. That is the BAFTA. I remember being so anxious that night because I knew I was getting this award. It wasn't like I was just maybe being... I was nominated. Yeah. I knew I was getting it. And because it was the special award, it was the last one of the night. So I had to sit there the whole evening, table at the front. So I had like easy access to the stage, knowing that I had to do a long speech at the end because it was a special award.
Yeah, because you knew you were going to get it, right?
Yeah. I was like really trying to really enjoy myself the whole night. And I was just a bundle of nerves. But obviously it was absolutely surreal. You know, when I first was... told that I was getting the special award, they send you a letter in the post being like, call this number if you accept. And I was thinking, who would not accept BAFTA?
Yeah, so I'm good.
Yeah, it's crazy. So I think I just felt so proud of myself. I was at a complete loss of words, to be honest. Looking back on that night, I can't remember much because I honestly blacked out while I read the speech and when I went up and received my BAFTA, and it's just on my mantelpiece and says like Nikki Lilly BAFTA special award. Yeah. Because it was a special award for everything that I'd done thus far, not just for one direct thing. It was like just it gave me a lot of time to reflect. And after my speech, people were like giving me a standing ovation and clapping, and I was just like, this is mental. Yeah, again, just a lot of proud feelings come to mind. Yeah, when I think about this. Amazing.
So just to kind of wrap things up, then I want to ask you, what is the one bit of advice you would say to somebody around resilience, discipline, like some of these things which have had to become so integral to your life? Like, what's one bit of advice you say to somebody who might be struggling with those things?
Firstly, if you're going through a hard time, especially, it's so important to not feel like you have to spring back and like you have to just pick yourself up and dust yourself off. It is okay to go when you're going through a tough time, not be okay. And if you need to just sit in your room and hibernate for like a week or however long you need to till you feel like you can get back to that place where you can, you know, pick yourself back up, that is okay. And there's nothing to be ashamed of. Sometimes all we can do is just be. Trying your best not to doubt that your importance and your place, you know, in this industry. I think this industry, there's so many different types of people in it now. It's more saturated than ever. And I think we all doubt ourselves. We all compare ourselves. It's what we do as humans, but especially in this industry that, you know, you're in, I'm in. And so I think it's just trying your best to remember that, like, what you're doing is worthwhile and what you're doing is making a difference. Nothing good or nothing worthwhile ever came easy, I'd say. And so if it is easy, then it's probably not worthwhile. And so I think, yeah, it's definitely going to be an uphill battle, but often the ones that are the hardest to get up are going to be the most worthwhile. And, you know, with me, I've learned that with having to kind of nudge through some doors and get into some places, it's always going to be more difficult for me than the average person and, like, you know, my community, but doesn't mean that you shouldn't be there. Make the best of the cards you've been dealt in life, to look back and be like, I made the most out of those. Yeah.
What a good place to end.
Yeah.
Nikki, thank you so much for coming on Unboxed.
Oh, thank you for having me. I've loved it.
So there you go, that is Nikki Lilly, and I'm so glad I got to speak to her. I knew this would be good, but it exceeded all my expectations sitting down with her. Again, I'm just shocked that she's done all of this at only 19 years old, and it's turned into this business which allows her to have amazing experiences, to work with great brands, and ultimately to inspire a whole generation of people to find their purpose, to find their values, to excel in whatever they're going through, and to inspire them to do so whilst enduring the realities of life, which are hard. And for someone like her, they are much harder than for the average person. And speaking with her, it just gave me a huge sense of motivation to take on all the things that I ever want to take on, and to do so with the same energy and the same fearlessness and determination and coolness that she does. Because if she can do it, and she is going through such hardship with her physical condition that is really challenging, then so can we. I'm so glad I got to speak to her. Immense thanks and love to Nikki for coming on and for sharing everything that she is going through and all the amazing things that she has done. And I hope that you all found it as inspiring as I did. Thank you very much for tuning in to Unboxed as ever. Make sure to like and subscribe, and we'll see you very soon.